as we do yearly for the flu. Another strategy is to go back to quarantines, lockdowns.
The People's Sound is calling. The Suwanee Perry Popolo Music Festival is back and online with free jazz, noise, punk, new music, spoken word, electronic, avant-rock, sound art, and dance parties. Over 60 artists performing from Montreal, Chicago, Philadelphia, Sioux Lookout, Toronto, Mexico City, Brussels, Berlin, Tehran, Kampala, and Nairobi. Heed the call between June 3rd and 21st at suwanneeperrypopolo.org.
Si on a appris quelque chose de la COVID-19, c'est qu'une petite chose peut se propager rapidement. Et si on est plusieurs à se faire vacciner, on peut créer une vague. Une vague de Canadiens qui font leur part pour retrouver les gens et les lieux qu'on aime. On peut tous aider en se faisant vacciner. Apprenez-en plus au canada.ca/vaccin-COVID. Un message du gouvernement du Canada.
And welcome to the June 17th edition of Dramatext. Tonight on the show we have an hour-long presentation by poet Jane Hirschfeld. It's presented by the University of California television series. So without any further ado, here she is, Jane Hirschfeld.
Well, I'm very grateful for that eloquent appreciation of my work. Thank you so much. It also helped me decide. I've been wavering about whether I should start with the recent work and go earlier or start with the earliest work and come up to the new book. And now I'll start with work from the new book and then we'll leap backwards. Can you hear me okay? Is this good? The envoy. One day in that room, a small rat. 2 days later, a snake, who, seeing me enter, whipped the long stripe of his body under the bed, then curled like a docile house pet. I don't know how either came or left. Later, the flashlight found nothing. For a year I watched as something, terror, happiness, grief, entered and then left my body, not knowing how it came in, not knowing how it went out. It hung where words could not reach it. It slept where light could not go. Its scent was neither snake nor rat, neither sensualist nor ascetic. There are openings in our lives of which we know nothing. Through them, the belled herds travel at will, long-legged and thirsty, covered with foreign dust. I think that most of us who work in the arts believe, of course, entirely and passionately in the importance of the arts in human life, that they do matter, that they do make a difference. And yet anyone who works in the arts is also going to be assailed with the guilt at times of thinking, why don't I do something useful? You know, there are people in the world who do things that are useful. And so this is a poem which comes out of that side of it. Some of you may recognize it starts describing a building about two-thirds of the way through, and that building is the Mormon Tabernacle, where the choir used to sing. I think they're building a new one for it now, but it's a pretty accurate description of the place. Mathematics. I have envied those who make something useful, sturdy. A chair, a pair of boots, even a soup rich with potatoes and cream, or those who fix perhaps a leaking window, strip out the old cracked putty, lay down cleanly the line of the new. You could learn, the mirror tells me, late at night, but lacks conviction. One reflected eyebrow quivers a little. I look at this borrowed apartment. Everywhere I question it, the wallpaper's pattern matches. Yesterday, a woman showed me a building shaped like the overturned hull of a ship, its roof trusses under the plaster lashed with soaked rawhide, the columns marble painted to seem like wood, though possibly it was the other way around. I look at my unhandy hand, innocent, shaped as others' hands are shaped. Even the pen it holds is a mystery, really. Rawhide it writes, and chair, and marble, eyebrow. Later, the woman asked me. I recognized her then, my sister, my own young self. Does a poem enlarge the world, or only our idea of the world? How do you take one from the other? I lied, or did not lie, in answer. The room. For 2 years it lay almost unentered, almost unoccupied, except for an insect hatch of empty cartons. Then something spiraled, stirred in a corner, demanded. And so came the sanding and painting, the washing of windows, replacing the cracked half glass of the door. So came a bed, a wooden dresser, a desk. Laying over the dresser's top, a dowry cloth from Uzbekistan, embroidered, cheerful, worn, absurdly expensive. Before the desk, a chair with woven seat. The hunt for a rug began. And during all that time, no idea at all of why these choices of furniture, this use. Late, the realization that something was being courted. And then a small tremble of exhilaration and fear. For still it was uncertain what was being prepared for, when the guest would come, or in whose shape, which half-starved, shivering hopes might follow it in. There's a poem by Frank O'Hara, quite a wonderful poem, called something like A True Story of Talking to the Sun at Fire Island. And when I read this next poem, I often think in my head a sort of false title for this, which is A True Story of My Birthday a Couple Years Ago. It is very literally an account of that day on which this poem was written. And it's a great way to spend a birthday, actually. I recommend it to you. Apple. I woke and remembered nothing of what I was dreaming. The day grew light, then dark again. In all its rich hours, what happened? A few weeds pulled, a few cold flowers carried inside for the vase. A little reading, a little tidying and sweeping. I had vowed to do nothing I did not wish to do that day, and kept my promise. Once a certain hope came close and then departed, passed by me in its familiar shawl, scented with iodine wood smoke. I did not speak to it, nor it to me. Yet still the habit of warmth traveled between us, like an apple shared by old friends. One takes a bite, then the other. They do this until it is gone. For any of you who know my earlier work, this book is surprisingly cluttered with human things. There aren't so many dressers and rugs and desks in my earlier books. Something seems to have altered, and the regular stuff of human life entered my work as a subject matter in a more, I don't know that it's normal, because all poets feel terribly abnormal, I suppose. I think all human beings feel abnormal. But, you know, the stuff that other people think about has become more present in my poems. So in this particular poem, what I was thinking about is how, to what extent the habitual governs our life, and how truly mysterious it is. You know, where does it come from, this stuff which in fact governs so much of what we do? So the poem is called Habit. The shoes put on each time, left first, then right. The morning potion's teaspoon of sweetness stirred always for seven circlings, no fewer, no more, into the cracked blue cup. Touching the pocket for wallet, for keys, before closing the door. How did we come to believe these small rituals promise that we are today the selves we yesterday knew, tomorrow will be? How intimate and unthinking the way the toothbrush is shaken dry after use, the part we wash first in the bath. Which habits we learned from others and which are ours alone, we may never know. Unbearable to acknowledge how much they are themselves our fated life. Open the traveling suitcase. There, the beloved red sweater, bright tangle of necklace, earrings of amber, each confirming, I chose these. I. But habit is different. It chooses. And we, its good horse, opening our mouths at even the sight of the bit. I think of this as my bitter little poem about aging. This was once a love poem. This was once a love poem before its haunches thickened, its breath grew short, before it found itself sitting, perplexed and a little embarrassed on the fender of a parked car, while many people passed by without turning their heads. It remembers itself dressing as if for a great engagement. It remembers choosing these shoes, this scarf or tie. Once it drank beer for breakfast, drifted its feet in a river side by side with the feet of another. Once it pretended shyness, then grew truly shy, dropping its head so the hair would fall forward, so the eyes would not be seen. It spoke with passion of history, of art. It was lovely then, this poem. Under its chin, no fold of skin softened. Behind the knees, no pad of yellow fat. What it knew in the morning, it still believed at nightfall. An unconjured confidence lifted its eyebrows, its cheeks. The longing has not diminished. Still, it understands. It is time to consider a cat, the cultivation of African violets or flowering cactus. Yes, it decides. Many miniature cacti in blue and red painted pots. When it finds itself disquieted by the pure and unfamiliar silence of its new life, it will touch them, one, then another, with a single finger outstretched like a tiny flame. There's a long tradition There's a recent tradition of American poets writing poems about objects. And again, you know, earlier this was not something I so much did, and suddenly objects became quite fascinating to me. I think this is actually the poem that began the intrusion of domestic objects into my work, and it's about a particularly small one. It's about a button, so it's called Button. It likes both to enter and to leave, actions it seems to feel as a kind of hide and seek. It knows nothing of what the cloth believes of its magus-like powers. If fastening and unfastening are its nature, it doesn't care about its nature. It likes the caress of two fingers against its slightly thickened edges. It likes the scent and heat of the proximate body. The exhilaration of the washing is its wild pleasure. A moralist, sensualist, dependent of cotton thread, its sleep is curled like a cat to a patch of sun, calico and round. Its understanding is the understanding of honey and jasmine, of letting what happens come. A button envies no neighboring button, no snap, no knot, no polyester braided toggle. It rests on its red-checked shirt in serene disregard. It is its own story, completed. Brevity and longevity mean nothing to a button carved of horn. Nor do old dreams of passion disturb it, though once it wandered the 10,000 grasses with the musk fragrance caught in its nostrils. Though once it followed, it did, I tell you, that wind for miles. This is a poem that touches on an experience I imagine everyone in the room has had. I don't think I need to say any more about it than that, except that I was really delighted. I don't think of myself as a person who often brings things into poetry which have never appeared there before, but I'm willing to wager that this might well be the first poem to ever feature badger colostrum in it. The first, before real milk comes in, colostrum comes in. And I just haven't come across another poem that has badger colostrum in it. Although, who knows, maybe it's going to start a fad. All evening, each time I started to say it. All evening, each time I started to say it, something would interrupt. It was not a thought so very large. It could, in fact, have slipped through any window, cracked open a bit for air. Yet each time I started to say it at that table, someone else would speak. The moment would pass. After the fifth time this happened, I began to be amused. Runt of the litter thought, I thought, unable to get to the tit. Then suddenly wanted to lift it up, to feed it an eyedropper's measure of mare's milk, some warmed sugar water, a little colostrum of badger. It suddenly seemed to me the kind of thought, not large, on which a life might turn. There are many such, unheard, unspoken. Their blind eyes open and close, the almost inaudible valves of their hearts. But all evening, each time I started to say it, something would interrupt. The moment would pass. I lived quite a long time ago in a place that had no heat or electricity or hot water. And this is a slight residue of that experience. A cedary fragrance. Even now, decades after, I wash my face with cold water. Not for discipline, nor memory, nor the icy awakening slap, but to practice choosing to make the unwanted wanted. The gallop. There are days the whole house moves at a gallop. Bookshelves and counters, bottles of aspirin and oil, chairs, saucepans, and towels. I can barely encircle the neck of a bounding pen with my fingers before it breaks free of their notions. Open the door before the dog of lop-eared hope sleeps through it. Pick up the paper before it goes up as kindling. Barely eat before something snatches the toast from my plate, drains the last mouthfuls of coffee out of my cup. Even these words, before the blue ink track has dried on the paper, they've already been read and agreed to or flung aside for others I don't yet know of. And well before I have dressed or brushed out the braid of my hair, a woman with my own shadow has showered and chosen her earrings, bought groceries and fallen in love, grown tired, grown old. Her braid in the mirror shines with new ribbons of silver, like the mane of a heavy warhorse. He stands in the silence as if after battle, sides heaving, spent. This is a short, odd poem. The title has very little to do with the poem. The title is "A Carbon-Based Life Form," in quotations, and that simply means us. All life on this earth is carbon-based life forms. A person tired from happiness grows sober. Another, worn through by sadness, stumbles into a kind of joy. It is like a dog alone in a house, barking to hear its own kind. Nothing needs to be added, yet we do. And the last poem from this book is what I think of as my second growth poem. I live in a town just north of San Francisco called Mill Valley, and it was named after the mill which took all the redwood trees off Mount Tamalpais. And if you look at photographs of Mill Valley from 50 years ago, it's a sunny place. And if you look at Mill Valley now, it's a shady place. The trees are coming back. Including some within my small domain. Tree. It is foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. That great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. Already the first branch tips brush at the window. Softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life. So now we're going back to the oldest poem that I still give at readings and often begin readings with. And I never know whether I should describe it as a love poem or as an end of love poem, because it is, in fact, both those things. For what binds us? There are names for what binds us. Strong forces, weak forces. Look around, you can see them. The skin that forms in a half-empty cup, nails rusting into the places they join, joints dovetailed on their own weight. The way things stay so solidly wherever they've been set down, and gravity, scientists say, is weak. And see how the flesh grows back across a wound with a great vehemence, more strong than the simple, untested surface before. There's a name for it on horses when it comes back darker and raised. Proud flesh. As all flesh is proud of its wounds, wears them as honors given out after battle, small triumphs pinned to the chest. And when two people have loved each other, see how it is like a scar between their bodies, stronger, darker, and proud. How the black cord makes of them a single fabric that nothing can tear or mend. I had expected an audience slightly more skewed towards students, I guess simply because it was a daytime reading. So I don't need to explain this poem to quite as many of you as I usually do. There's something in it. It's a poem which will date me very nicely for you. Its title is a year. The year is 1973. And it is talking about my first job after graduating from college, which was doing farm labor in New Jersey. And there are many references to the period, most of which, you know, even now, people who weren't born then, you know about the Vietnam War, and you probably know about the novelist Ken Kesey, and you might know about his then-girlfriend Mountain Girl, who went on to become Jerry Garcia's girlfriend, and you know, all that stuff is okay. But the one thing which really does have to be told younger people is in the ancient days, cars had something called manual chokes. And on cold mornings, when you started your car, there was this little knob on the dashboard that you had to pull out to change the fuel-air mixture or your car would die. And so I have to tell you this because otherwise you'll think I was eating artichokes for breakfast, and I was not. Okay. 1973. That winter, we took turns stepping into the barely started mornings to turn ignitions until they caught, complaining roughly of the cold, then ran back to finish our coffee, cereal, toast, while chokes pulled full out, exhaust poured white across the glass that kept us warm. We'd named them Big Mama Tomato, Snooze. Each was our first, as we were each other's first, in the farmhouse for rent for the first time in 40 years surrounded by soybeans. We'd whited over the pink room the sun had painted when he returned crazed with Vietnam. We'd made the man come back for the thin black lab left chained in the yard. The 13 cats stayed, soon more, all wild. Our own would come to the window by way of a three-story oak and moss-shingled porch roof to mew us awake and them in every day. Keezy and Mountain Girl, scrawling their signatures, snow mornings, on the quilt. We nailed planks from the old barns onto the walls by our bed, scraped a dozen layers of peeling paper from the next room. The older they got, the more lovely. That one we made cheerful yellow, where I wrote the wildly sad poems of the very young. When we got to the farm, you took a tractor, I loaded my van with sacks of produce and drove off. Kip supervised us all, the Peace Corps vet, the kids just out of school, picking his peaches that summer, the best work I've done, the closest to paradise I've seen, ladder propped in his trees. All sold now, gone. His farm, the one we lived at, the groundfall cider, the cars. Us too, of course, long shaken free, though I still cook bluefish the way you taught me, and carrots. I thought I would love you forever, and a little I may, in the way I still move toward a crate, knees bent, or reach for a man, as one might stretch for the three or four fruit that lie in the sun at the top of the tree. Too ripe for any moment but this, they open their skin at first touch, yielding sweetness, sweetness and heat. And in me, each time since, the answering yes. The love of aged horses. Because I know tomorrow his faithful gelding heart will be broken when the spotted mare is trailered and driven away, I come today to take him for a gallop on Diaz Ridge. Returning, he will whinny for his love. Ancient, spavined, her white parts red with hill dust, her red parts whitened with the same, she never answers. But today, when I turn him loose at the bent gate, with the taste of chewed oat on his tongue and the saddle sweat rinsed off with water, I know he will canter, however tired, whinnying wildly up the ridge's near side, and I know he will find her. He will be filled with the sureness of horses whose bellies are grain-filled, whose long-ribbed loneliness can be scratched into no longer lonely. His long teeth on her withers, her rough-coated spots will grow damp and wild. Her long teeth on his withers, his oiled teakwood smoothness will grow damp and wild. Their shadows crisscross will fleck and fill with flies, the eight marks of their fortune stamp and then cancel the earth. From ear flick to tail switch, they stand in one body. No luck is as boundless as theirs. I feel so badly for the people coughing. I have this wonderful glass of water up here. I could give it to you, but then only one of you would want it. So, okay, we're approaching. We're getting closer to the present now. So, just a few poems from what used to be my most recent book, and as of today, no longer is. This first one is has a word in it which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, but in case anybody isn't. The word is koan, and a koan is the testing question used in Rinzai Zen practice. The most famous one amongst general American currency is what is the sound of one hand? Another one might be show me your face before your parents were born. So you know, unanswerable questions which yet can somehow be met. And this poem, while it's not completely about this, a great deal of it is describing two monks who basically flunk their koan. They're trying to deal with this, and they can't. The heart's counting knows only one. In Sung China, two monks, friends for 60 years, watched the geese pass. Where are they going? One tested the other, who couldn't say. That moment's silence continues. No one will study their friendship in the koan books of insight. No one will remember their names. I think of them sometimes, standing perplexed by sadness, goose down sewn into their quilted autumn robes. Almost swallowed by the vastness of the mountains, but not yet. As the barely audible geese are not yet swallowed. As even we, my love, will not entirely be lost. The second to last book has a lot of poems which I think of as recipes for getting through difficult times in one's life. So, you know, if one poem doesn't work, you can try another. There are various strategies. And I think I've only picked out one to read you today. And this one literally is a recipe. It's a very good recipe. And if you would like to make it, you can find it in the First Greens cookbook. I come by it honorably. I cooked at Greens for 3 years. Annie Lamott once said that there's no woman writer who hasn't done her time in the food service industry. And so far, I've asked around, and it seems to be so. Everybody's either waitressed or cooked or something. The title of the poem is an Italian term from music, da capo, and it appears at the end of a piece of music and is an instruction to go back and play it again from the top. Da capo. Take the used-up heart like a pebble and throw it far out. Soon there is nothing left. Soon the last ripple exhausts itself in the weeds. Returning home, slice carrots, onions, celery. Glaze them in oil before adding the lentils, water, and herbs. Then the roasted chestnuts, a little pepper, the salt. Finish with goat cheese and parsley. Eat. You may do this, I tell you. It is permitted. Begin again the story of your life. Three Foxes by the Edge of the Field at Twilight. One ran, her nose to the ground, a rusty shadow, neither hunting nor playing. One stood, sat, lay down, stood again. One never moved, except to turn her head a little as we walked. Finally, we drew too close, and they vanished. The woods took them back as if they had never been. I wish I had thought to put my face to the grass. But we kept walking, speaking as strangers do when becoming friends. There is more and more I tell no one, strangers nor loves. This slips into the heart without hurry, as if it had never been. And yet among the trees, something has changed. Something looks back from the trees and knows me for who I am. Okay, three more poems, and two of them are short, weird poems. So you're in the last furlong of the gallop here. the bearded woman. Each time she noticed, she had meant to pluck the three black hairs, but the days were short. Her fingers touched her chin, then forgot. Thus fatigue grew curling into wisdom. So that's short and weird in one way. This is short and weird in another. It's kind of a riddle, and I won't tell you the answer if you ask me in the Q&A. People have tried. I'll tip you off to what the riddle is. The poem is called Lying, and your job, after you've heard it, is, you know, some poems only complete themselves when you've chewed them over a little bit. They aren't finished with what's on the page. They have to finish with something added by the reader or the listener. Even by me, when I wrote it, I still had to add this component. So the poem is called Lying, and what has to happen for it to be complete is you have to try to figure out what part of it is the lie. He puts his brush to the canvas, with one quick stroke, unfolds a bird from the sky, steps back, considers, takes pity, unfolds another. And the last poem I'll read, I'll give you a little background on. I was staying at a retreat for scholars and artists in Italy that the Rockefeller Foundation runs in Bellagio on Lake Como. And this was a kind of extraordinary experience. I've been to artist retreats in America before, and they're amazing. You get to concentrate on your work for a month without distraction. Your meals are provided. Somebody changes your sheets and vacuums once a week. You're given a bedroom and a workspace. And it's an amazing opportunity to sink deeply into only doing the one thing you most want to be doing. But Bellagio, because it's in Italy, because it's the Rockefeller Foundation, because it's scholars as well as artists, and I guess scholars live higher than artists, it's kind of like a cross between a five-star hotel and one of those English country manors you see in the movies, and an artist colony. And I was quite intimidated by being there. I felt quite guilty that all of this existed and that I was getting to benefit from it. And I was thinking about all of the particularly poets who live in circumstances so much less blessed than mine, even in normal life, let alone there. Poets for whom publication might be impossible, for whom even having sufficient paper might be impossible. And yet, you know that great work is being done. I may never get the chance to see these poems, and yet I am confident that all over the earth, in obscure corners, in obscure languages, poems that I will never get to read, and maybe no one will ever get to read, are being written. And this matters enormously to me. So that is what lies behind this. The poet. She is working now in a room not unlike this one, the one where I write or you read. Her table is covered with paper. The light of the lamp would be tempered by a shade where the bulb's single harshness might dissolve. But it is not. She has taken it off. Her poems, I will never know them, though they are the ones I most need. Even the alphabet she writes in, I cannot decipher. Her chair. Let us imagine whether it is leather or canvas, vinyl or wicker. Let her have a chair, her shadeless lamp, the table. Let one or two she loves be in the next room. Let the door be closed, the sleeping ones healthy. Let her have time and silence, enough paper to make mistakes and go on. Thank you. I've never read a poem where it was more appropriate to have a baby gurgling in the back of the room than for that one. So, as I understand it, anyone now who would like to talk about anything, this is when we do.
I first saw you on the Bill Moyer series. It was fabulous.
Thank you.
And as a writer, I want to ask you, how do you prepare yourself to write? Do you write longhand, computer? What is your technique?
Mm-hmm. You know, when you first asked, how do you prepare yourself to write, the answer which leapt into my mind was, that's been a lifetime's enterprise. But I think you mean it in a slightly more confined sense than that. You know, I have, over my life, I have worked in a number of different processes as far as the technology is concerned. I mean, you asked particularly about what the technology is. And for many, many years, starting, I think I learned to type with two fingers when I was in third grade, and I typed a lot of my work when I was young. But I also wrote longhand a great deal when I was young because I was writing at 2 a.m. and hiding things under my bed, which I thought my mother wasn't seeing. For me, poetry was a very private activity in which I basically cultivated a self, and it was something done in secrecy and just for myself. And I'm still surprised now that I actually do things like publish poems or give readings, because I know how deeply it was rooted in solitude and how much it still is. And so the one preparation which never changes is, I will never be one of those who writes in a crowded cafe. Some do. Some very good poets can only write in public, surrounded by the buzz of human life and human language. And for me, the most essential thing is undisturbed time and space. The feeling that nothing is going to come crashing through the door. One of the great discoveries of recent years that poem Apple about my birthday refers to is I learned I could unplug the phones. You know, not just turn the ringer off, detach them. Makes a huge psychological difference for me to be able to do that. So for years, you know, at first I hand wrote, I typed, I worked on computers for some years, and now I'm back to handwriting again. My current pattern is to wake up in the morning, make the essential mug of latte, which has been a lifelong, it's my one great vice, I must have my morning coffee. And then often, not always, but often if my life can be quiet that day, if I don't have to have the phone plugged in for some reason, I will write first thing in the morning, in bed, longhand. And for some reason that I don't understand, but I know there's a poem in the new book which refers to probably where it started. I write on my old paper. It's like discarded drafts, because then I do, you know, work on them a great deal more, of course. But on the back sides of old drafts that I'm no longer keeping, I tear the paper in half and I keep it in a pile next to the bed. And that's what I'm writing my first drafts on. This is just absolutely inexplicable to me. It is such a strange thing to be doing. But I've done it for about a year and a half now. And the poem that started it was teaching at a writer's conference, the Port Townsend Writers Conference up in Washington State. And I usually never wrote. When I'm teaching, when I'm on the road, I don't write. But for some reason, up there that time, I had a cabin. The cabin had a typewriter. I was writing. And I hadn't brought any paper with me because I hadn't expected to write. And one morning, and I realized I was down to like 2 sheets. I'd only had maybe 10 sheets of blank paper with me. And one morning I woke up from, you know, a heavy, dreamless sleep with an auditory, you know, a sort of voice saying to me, use your failures for paper. And what it meant quite literally was, you know, the 9 sheets of paper in the wastebasket, you can use the back of them. And I've been doing that ever since. It's like compost. So I don't think these are things that other people should emulate. You know, we ask writers how they write in the hope that, you know, maybe something will allow us to you know, I love, you know, many poets go around now saying, you must write every day, you must do it when you first wake up, or you must do it at 5 in the afternoon, you must make an appointment with your muse, you must do this, you must do that. I don't think there's anything anyone must do. I think our task is to find what works for us, which will change over the course of a lifetime, as mine certainly has. I mean, writing first thing in the morning, I was a night person all my life. The idea that I could wake up and write poetry would have been laughable to me 10 years ago. And then something switched, and now that's what I do. But if any of you want to take your old drafts and tear them in half and leave them next to the bed, you know, go ahead, try it. Maybe it'll work for you. But mostly I think you find out what does work for you, and you follow that like a hound dog following a scent to see what your muse is pleased by. And then be open to surprises. Be open to suddenly going back to longhand after years on a computer. And you know, I co-teach with Sven Burkertz, who I'm afraid might murder me if he heard me say that I sometimes have written on a computer for years. But my own experience of it is it makes no difference to the kinds of poem that I write, what technology I use. I hear the poems, and all I want is to get what I hear onto paper. And then I will revise by whatever means are available. You know, if that means 80 sheets of paper done by hand, that's what I'll do. I don't think the process influences the outcome. I think he might be correct. I don't know if any of you even know what I'm talking about when I just say Sven Burkertz. The Gutenberg Elegies is a marvelous book, brilliant, gorgeous writing. He's a fabulous critic. But he does say that writing on computer will ruin your writing, that it will ruin your thinking. It will make you quick and sloppy and casual. And my own experience is it doesn't. That's all I mean to say. Another question?
I was wondering, I want to slip in 2 questions, actually. I'm curious about what your influences have been in writing, both in terms of Zen practice and other writers, and I'm also wondering what your revision process is, how much time you spend revising.
Influences are far and wide. You know, I think the earliest book of poetry that I ever bought, I was 9 years old, and I bought a little collection of haiku in one of those dollar Peter Popper press editions, and I adored it. I don't know what I was understanding them as. I was a child growing up in New York City reading, you know, nature poetry from Japan, but I knew something in there mattered to me. And that love of Japanese poetry has, of course, recurred throughout my life. I did a co-translation of 2 women poets from the Heian era. And so that has been a deep influence from early on. But so, of course, has been the English sonnet. Particularly, I think, you know, Milton's sonnets, Shakespeare's sonnets, Keats, Wordsworth. Shelley, for some reason, less. Of all the romantic poets, he's the one that I've never quite taken to. And every time I go back, I kind of have the same experience. You know, maybe one poem will sneak in, but mostly there's something about Shelley's temperament and mine which don't accord. I took Latin when I was young. I've forgotten it all, but Horace and Catullus were huge influences on me, not only as poets, and they are remarkable poets. I mean, so wild and colloquial and vivid. And, you know, they are the Frank O'Haras of their day. There's no question about it. Frank O'Hara is not actually an influence on me, but Horace and Catullus were. But also, the Stoic and Epicurean philosophy is quite close to Zen. Carpe Diem and Zen, you know, their poems are full of references to the transience of the world. And so they sent me towards Buddhism, as much as Japanese or Chinese poetry sent me towards Buddhism. I have, of course, read a great deal of classical Chinese and Japanese poetry in translation. But then, you know, I go all over the map. I've gone through periods, the Greek poet Sepphoris a long time ago, and then between then and now fell completely in love with Cavafy, who I'm still in love with, the Russian poet Mandelstam, the contemporary Polish poets, Czesław Miłosz, of course, Zimborska, Zbigniew Herbert, who's now dead, they were important to me. Bertolt Brecht's poems were important to me. I mean, I'm just all over. Galway Kinnell, early Merwin, Adrian Rich. I mean, from each of them, something has been taken. Rich taught me that it was okay to think in poetry. The dream of a common language, those long-lined poems in which she thinks and feels at the same time. Enormous permission given to me as a young woman poet from those poems. She translated some Ghazals of the Urdu poet Ghalib. That sent me back to the scholarly book on Ghalib. He was an influence on me. So, you know, I just, I'll dance with anybody. and what was the second question? Revision process. I love revision. Somewhere along the line, it stopped being something that was, I mean, Lord knows when it's not working out, it's still painful. You know, when I've got three quarters of it there and I can't bring it the rest of the way, in that process it's awful. But when I'm not right, I imagine it's like childbirth. You forget the pain most of the time. And what I now feel about revision is to revise is as good as to write. It is a re-immersion into the creative calling forth of a clarified being in this world. And for me, the pleasure of making a poem better, truer, weirder, stranger, wilder of diction, simpler, any of those directions that a poem will want to go, it's the same thrill as writing the first draft. Now, some of my poems come out pretty clean, and they don't change hugely from first draft to completion. Others, I mean, I wasn't joking when I said 80 pages. I have revised poems 85 times, going wildly different directions en route, poems that were very problematic and difficult for me to figure out, what am I doing here? There was something I couldn't let go of, but I didn't know what it was. And for me, the process is very much asking the poem, what are you? What do you want to be? What needs to come forth to make you more completely yourself? It feels like a dialogue. It's not me telling something what to do. It's something telling me what it wants me to help it do. And so I'm as happy to revise as to write, although of course you have to write first in order to have something to revise. And I think that change of attitude from, oh, it's not good enough, to this is a chance to discover something, made all the difference.
So that concludes this week's edition of Dromos Text. We were listening to the work of Jane Hirschman, poet from Southern California. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation of the spoken word. Till then.
Si on a appris quelque chose de la COVID-19, c'est qu'une petite chose peut se propager rapidement. Et si on est plusieurs à se faire vacciner, on peut créer une vague. Une vague de Canadiens qui font leur part pour retrouver les gens et les lieux qu'on aime. On peut tous aider en se faisant vacciner. Apprenez-en plus au canada.ca/vaccin-covid. Un message du gouvernement du Canada.
Oh, merci beaucoup, Madame Saint-Onge. On va faire l'intro de Francis et les exerciceurs sur les ondes de CKUT Radio-McGill.